put that. That ain't gonna work. I'll knock it off.
Okay, there you go.
I'll try not to knock it off.
All right, try.
Okay. I want to look at something. Maybe I don't know if you've ever looked at this before. This is sort of new for me too. I want to understand the trajectory of Jesus' ministry, the structure of it, and I think this is very important. And it's important to Luke because 10 chapters in the middle of his gospel are just the final trip. Talking about the trajectory of Jesus' ministry, they're the final trip from Caesarea Philippi, way up in the north, to Jerusalem. And so, just as a broad overview, looking at all the Gospels, Jesus' ministry begins solo. He starts his ministry before he calls any disciples. We know this. He has a synagogue ministry where he teaches in the synagogue and does healing before he ever picks the disciples. And then there's this period, mostly in Galilee, of this ministry. He'll go down to Jerusalem for the Passover, okay? Two times, and then he'll go to the final Passover when the crucifixion happens. And I did a little homework. You know, you're always looking for someone who'll do your homework for you. Well, I did your homework for you. And this final journey to Jerusalem, this is interesting to me. In Matthew, it begins with the confession of Peter. We're going to look at this in Luke, so don't feel like you've got to write it down now. Matthew, in chapter 16, gives the confession of Peter. Jesus gets to Jerusalem, arrives in chapter 21. So five chapters is this final journey. Mark just has three chapters. Peter's confession is in 8:27. Jesus arrives in Jerusalem in chapter 3. Chapter 11. So it's just three chapters. Luke, in chapter 9, Jesus resolutely sets his face for Jerusalem, and he doesn't get there until chapter 19. Luke has 10 chapters on the final journey. So I would like to say this is because Luke was a companion of Paul, and they spent most of their ministry traveling. And so he does this presentation of Jesus, the great central section of Luke is the final journey to Jerusalem. And every other paragraph, there's as he was traveling along, as they were going through this city, as they were on their way, it's a travel narrative. He's moving the whole time. And so I want to look at when that begins after the confession of Peter. And really interesting to me is during this travel narrative, twice, he has meal fellowship with Pharisees. We already saw the first meal, right, that he had with Simon the Pharisee, right, and the sinful woman. Remember when we looked at that? And that was a very congenial meal. Nobody's yelling at everything. No, he's not throwing anything or calling anybody a brood of vipers. We're going to look at meal two, I think it's in chapter 11. Yeah. And that meal doesn't go so well. Frankly, he starts pronouncing the woes, and it's not good. But then in chapter 14, we have another pretty friendly meal. And interesting that two of the three meals are very congenial meals. We have this lopsided view of the Pharisees. There's a small clutch of Pharisees who are hounding Jesus. But then he has Nicodemus is a Pharisee, Joseph of Arimathea is a Pharisee. They bury Jesus. Leadership in the early church was almost all Pharisaic. So the Pharisees aren't all bad guys, but we have sort of a warped view of the Pharisees because there's this small group that's hounding him. And we're going to see them in Luke. They don't like the fact he doesn't wash his hands. He doesn't do the things he's supposed to do. And I brought my Pharisee Bible with me. There's 8 pages on how to wash your hands. And I'm going to read to you some of the mind-numbing details that Jesus is fighting against. So if I forget, remind me. I'm going to read that to you. So we're going to start with Peter's confession in 9:18. So in terms of the trajectory of the ministry, he begins a solo ministry that's pretty. There's not huge crowds. He's just in the synagogues. He chooses the disciples, and he starts doing miracles, and the ministry skyrockets. All of a sudden, we have feeding of the 5,000, feeding of the 4,000. We have Jesus saying things like, have a boat ready so the people don't push me into the lake. This is what Mark is really interested in. Mark is interested in the fact that the ministry is just covered up. So, fairly obscure ministry by himself in the synagogue, calls the disciples, starts doing miracles, and it just skyrockets. And then, as I read it, and I'm not going to be dogmatic about this, this is just me trying to put the puzzle together. But what happens is, he starts saying things like, Jesus' standard synagogue sermon is that God reaches out to Gentiles before he reaches out to Jews. Well, that doesn't go over so well. In Nazareth, they're going to kill him for saying, they're going to throw him off a cliff for saying that. He says things like, you've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And at the point where he might have said, I'm just speaking symbolically, he says, no, my flesh is real food and my blood is real drink. He says that in a synagogue in Capernaum. These are kosherate Jews who don't even eat pork, right? And so I suggest to you that huge spike in popularity, and then there's a gradual erosion of his popularity. So that we get to Matthew 17, Jesus and Peter come back to Capernaum, and it's just the two of them. There's no huge crowd. You know, earlier, you can't even get into the house because so many people are there. So I suggest to you, and again, I wouldn't be dogmatic. I'm just trying to kind of read between the lines. So we have a gradual erosion, and then the final Jerusalem, a final trip to Jerusalem, which we're going to overview tonight. Then he gets to Jerusalem, and we're going to look at the so-called triumphal entry. And because you were probably thinking, oh, no, he's still very popular because he's got this huge crowd when he enters Jerusalem. You got to know, if he wasn't there, there's still a huge crowd entering Jerusalem. They're coming for Passover. There's thousands, tens of thousands of people crowding the roads coming in for Passover. Jesus' group is a momentary blip in that huge crowd. I'm not saying he's not popular and there's not a group of people around him saying Hosanna. That's clear in the text. But we have the triumphal entry is not the triumph sometimes that I think we think it is. So again, you help me with this. I mean, you go home and look at it and tell me tomorrow or tell me next week if you think this is crazy or not. Be nice. Be nice. Don't be mean. But I think this is important to understand that it's not just he begins his ministry and kind of ticks along and then goes to Jerusalem and gets killed and resurrected. I think there's an isolated solo ministry, huge spike in popularity, and then a gradual erosion because people just can't accept what he says. And then Jerusalem, a cross and resurrection. Okay? So this kind of stuff is important to me. I'm working on the details and what they mean. So let's look at Peter's confession. And what you need to know is Peter's confession is where everything turns around. They go up to Caesarea Philippi. Some of you have been to Caesarea Philippi, I know. It's way up in the north. It's a pagan area. There's the cave of Pan is there. There's a big cave that it was thought that was the entrance to Hades. Pan was worshipped there. The goats were worshipped there. It's a very pagan place. And to this day, it bothers me that he took them up there. I still don't know. It's 25 miles up from Galilee, up through the mountains, to get to Caesarea Philippi. Now, my mentor, William Lane, said Jesus wanted them to confess who he was in the face of raw paganism. That was his reason for going to Caesarea Philippi. That's not a good enough reason for me to walk 25 miles. I still don't know why he did it. It puzzles me. And there's a lot of things about him that puzzled me. But so they go up to Caesarea Philippi. It's also called Peneus after Pan, the god Pan, because he's worshipped there. Okay? So this is verse 18. Get to the text. Once when Jesus was praying, and you need to know that Luke, more than any other gospel, is interested in the prayer life of Jesus. Before he does anything major in Luke, he prays. Only Luke will tell us that the transfiguration, Jesus was praying when that happened. Only Luke tells us that. So he's very interested in the prayer life of Jesus. So once when Jesus was praying in private and his disciples were with him, he asked them, who do the crowds say I am? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets of long ago, has come back to life. So the answer is, they really don't know who he is. And even the people who say he's the Messiah, they don't know what the Messiah is. There are a number of different ideas about who the Messiah is. Some people think he's a military leader. Some people think he's a religious leader. In Judaism today, there are people that believe there are two Messiahs. I mean, there's all this confusion about who the Messiah is. Okay. So, I mean, to think that he's John the Baptist, come back to life again. But what about you, he asked. Who do you say I am? Peter answered, the Christ of God. Now, in the other Gospels, Jesus will bless Peter for saying that. Luke leaves that out. Jesus strictly warned them not to tell this to anyone. Isn't that interesting? We call that the messianic secret. He does this a lot. He'll heal someone and he'll say, don't tell anyone I did that. Of course, they always tell. How can you not tell? And the way it works in Mark, it happens most frequently in the Gospel of Mark. The way it works in Mark is people tell anyway, and he's so covered up with people who just want miracles that he has to flee to the wilderness. That happens over and over and over again in the Gospel of Mark. So Peter makes his confession, and Jesus says, okay, don't tell anybody what that means. And I think the main reason is he's going to spend the next 10 chapters explaining to them what it means to be the Messiah, because they have no idea what it means. They certainly don't think it means to die on a cross and suffer. That's not part of, you know, the messianic understanding of who Jesus is. So, verse 21, he strictly warned them not to tell this to anyone. And he said, the Son of Man must suffer. And they're going, no, that will never happen. You know, Peter says, that'll never happen to you, right? Must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law. And when you hear those three groups, that's the Sanhedrin. That's the three groups that make up the Sanhedrin. And he must be killed and on the third day raised to life. And he's going to repeat this over and over and over again on this long central section on this final journey. He's going to add more details. He's going to say, I'm going to be spat upon. I'm going to be bound. You know. And at one point, they're going to argue about what rising from the dead might mean. Because it can't be rising from the dead. That can't happen, right? That makes no sense, at least to the disciples. Then he said to them all, if anyone will come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily. So I'm going to be crucified, and if you're going to follow me, you're going to have to take up your cross too. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his very self or his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory and in the glory of the Father with the holy angels. I tell you the truth. That's amen. That's his way of saying, I'm about to say something really important. Amen. Some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God. And that is always the preface for the transfiguration. That's how all the gospels tell us about the transfiguration. They're going to see the kingdom of God. Okay? So the next thing is the transfiguration or the unveiling. About 8 days after this, he took Peter, James, and John, the three, and went up onto a mountain to pray. There it is. As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. So he becomes radiant. Now, this isn't a transformation. This is a transfiguration. Jesus, he's just being unveiled. The true person that he has been all along is just being unveiled. Okay, he's always been this glorious, radiant person. Just the veil is being, so very important. Not a transformation. His form isn't changing. He's being transfigured. So he's, you know, gloriously radiant. Two men, Moses and Elijah. Moses is a person who died and went to heaven. Elijah is a guy who went straight to heaven and didn't die. And that's the only kind of people that are going to be in the kingdom. People that died and people who are alive when Jesus comes back. And so this is kind of a picture of the kingdom. Moses and Elijah appeared in glorious splendor talking with Jesus. They spoke about his exodus, his departure. So we're getting ready for Jesus to leave, to go to Jerusalem for the last time. And that's what Jesus is talking to Moses and Elijah about. They're talking about his departure. Okay? Pretty cool, huh? It's interesting that he's talking to Moses, Jesus is, about his exodus. They spoke about his departure, which he was to bring to fulfillment in Jerusalem. My note says, this is all in preparation for the travel narrative. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As the men were leaving, Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here." I want to translate as a question. Is it good for us to be here? I'm not so sure. I like it as a question. Let us put up three shelters, tabernacles, Sukkoth. Some people think that this happened during the season of tabernacles and that Peter was just saying, we need to build tabernacles for the three of you. Some people are thinking Peter is afraid. The context of this is fear. And he wants shelters. He wants to put them in shelters to protect them from the radiance, from the glory, right? Because it's not a good thing to be seeing this. It's a dangerous thing. Luke doesn't make as much of the context of fear that the other Gospels do, but they're all afraid. So should we build three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah? Here's a rare parenthetical statement. Luke doesn't do this. John does. John explains things in parenthetical asides. Luke doesn't do that, but he explains he did not know what he was saying, which almost certainly means he said the wrong thing, right? That's what that alludes to. He didn't know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and enveloped them. I suggest to you, Peter's afraid. He wants to cover them up, right? And what does God do? He provides a cloud that covers them up. I think it was in response to Peter's fear, perhaps. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and enveloped them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my son." See, I combine this with Peter's confession. "You're the Christ." See, Jesus is being defined. You know, now God himself says, "This is my son whom I've chosen. Listen to him." In 8:18, Jesus warned them, "Consider carefully how you listen." When the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone. The disciples kept this to themselves and told no one at that time what they had seen. We're going to keep this to ourselves. Okay? So let's go to the first or the second meal. This is 11:37. And this is the one that doesn't go so well. What we have during these 10 chapters is tons of teaching. As they are making their way to Jerusalem, he's teaching and telling parables the whole time. So 11:37. My NIV, the heading is six woes, but the heading I wrote in, this is Jesus in contrast with Pharisaic Judaism. This is the contrast between the two. Verse 37, when Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. So he went in and reclined. Did we talk about this? Okay, very important. This is Hellenism. You recline at a low three-sided table, a triclinium. You lean on your left elbow, because your left hand is your bathroom hand, so to speak, and you eat with your right hand. And this presupposes a culture where slaves cut your food up for you. You eat with one hand in Jesus' world, so the food's already been cut up. So he's reclining at the triclinium, but the Pharisees, noticing that Jesus did not first wash before the meal, was surprised. Okay, I brought my Mishnah. This is the Pharisaic Bible. This is the saying of the rabbis from 200 BC to 200 AD. And there are 8 pages on how to wash your hands. Let me just read you some of the detail. This is the world that Jesus is in. This is in the tractate Yadim. Yad is your hand. So hands. This is the tractate called Hands. "To render the hands clean, a quarter log
or more of water must be poured over their hands to suffice for one person or even for two. A half log or more suffices for three persons or for four. One log or more suffices for five or for 10 or for 100. I know. I don't get it either. Rabbi Jose says, provided that for the last among them there remains not less than one quarter log, more water may be added to the second water that is poured over the hands, but more may not be added to the first. That's the first paragraph. There's eight pages of this. This is section two. The water may be poured over the hands out of any vessel, even from vessels made from cattle dung, or vessels of stone, or vessels of unbaked clay. It may not be poured over the hands out of the sides of broken vessels, so you can't use a broken vessel, or out of the flanks of a ladling jar, I don't even know what that is, or out of the plug of a jar, nor may a man pour it over his fellow's hands out of his cupped hands, where they may not draw the water or mix the ashes or sprinkle the sin offering water or pour water over the hands, save only in a vessel and only vessels that have a tightly stopped up cover afforded protection against uncleanness. And only vessels afford protection against uncleanness in earthenware vessels. Okay, it goes on and on and on. And it's different rabbis' opinions. And to this day, here's somebody, Gamaliel said, a rabbi in Gamaliel said to him, scripture says an Ammonite or a Moabite, we're still talking about washing your hands, by the way, shall not enter into the assembly of the Lord even in the 10th generation, but are the Ammonites and the Moabites still where they were long ago? Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up and put all the nations in confusion. We're still talking about washing our hands. I have removed the bounds of the peoples and have robbed their treasures. The Aramaic version, that is Ezra and Daniel, renders the hands unclean. So here's the other odd thing. If you touch something holy, it makes your hands unclean. You can't touch a Torah scroll. It makes your hands unclean. Not because it's unclean. This makes no sense to us. We're not talking about cleanliness in terms of bacteria. We're talking about ritual cleanliness. Okay? So there's a whole long discussion about what renders the hands unclean. And one of the things that renders the hands unclean is the Torah. You can't touch it. And so I didn't bring it, but I've got a long stick. It's called a yad. I've got a long stick that's got a pointer. And when you read the Torah, you have to point it because you're not supposed to touch it because it makes you unclean. This is a hard world to understand. A Galilean heretic, maybe Jesus, said, I crowd against you, O Pharisees, for ye write in a bill of divorce the name of the ruler together with the name of Moses. The Pharisees said, we crowd against thee, O thou Galilean heretic, for ye write the name of the ruler against the name of God and on the same page. And moreover, ye write the name of the ruler above the name of God, as it is written. And Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should hearken unto his voice to let Israel go? Clear. Are you sufficiently confused? That's the world of the Pharisees. Someone was talking about when we were in Israel. When you walk into a restaurant, there's a sink and there's a metal pot or metal a pitcher that has two handles. Okay, and Laura was asking me, I think what the two handles are for. If I'm an observant Jew, I go in. I grab with my unclean hand, I grab one handle, I fill it with water, I pour it. I'm not washing with soap. This has nothing to do with being clean. Okay? I pour water over this hand, it's clean. I grab the other handle, right? And then I fill the pitcher and I pour it over this handle. And I set the pitcher down, and the next person comes up and uses it. It's not like anybody's going to wash the pitcher in between it. This is not about cleanliness. It's about ceremonial cleanliness. Okay? All that to say, Jesus is at a meal, and he hasn't done any of this, and it really bugs the Pharisees. I want you to enter into the confusion of this world. That's what this world is about. Okay.
So Jesus is reclining at the table, and the Pharisees are upset that he did not first wash before the meal. In fact, it says they were surprised. Okay, then back to the text, and now it's going to get clear. Then the Lord said to them, "Now then, you Pharisees, clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness, you foolish people. Did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? But give what is inside to the poor, and everything will be clean to you." Another long argument in the Mishnah is, when I have a pot, do I wash the inside first or the outside first? There are pages and pages of this. And the two great rabbis, Shammai and Hillel, those are the two rabbis you need to know, whose names you need to know. Shammai was fairly severe. He said, you only wash the outside of the cup. Again, this is ceremonial cleanliness. This isn't bacterial cleanliness. Hillel said, no, you wash the inside first and then the outside. And this argument rages on and on and on. But you see how Jesus is referring to this, okay? You Pharisees say, clean the outside of the cup, but not the inside. Jesus says, this makes no sense. You know, I'm sorry, we're degenerating into this confusion, but it's confusing. The point is, Jesus says, give what's in the cup to the poor. If you really want to be clean, care for the poor. Don't worry about washing the inside or the outside or pouring over, you know, your right or your left hand. Let's give what's inside the cup to the poor. Okay. Now here come the woes. And woe is oi. You've heard Jewish people say oy vey. This is oi. Okay. So woe to you Pharisees, because you give a tenth of your mint, rue, and all kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and hesed, love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. So he doesn't say you shouldn't tithe. He's just saying you should love people and care about the justice of God and do those things. Okay? Right? You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. So he's not saying don't tithe. He's saying, you should love God and care about justice. Woe to you Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you, because you are like unmarked graves, which men walk over without knowing it. In Judaism, graves are always painted white. So you don't accidentally, because if you step over one, that makes you unclean. And it's a long, complicated process to become clean again. All the graves on the Mount of Olives are all white. The stones are all white. Woe to you Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you, because you're like unmarked graves, which men walk over without knowing it. One of the experts in the law answered him, "Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us also." So he's a scribe. Jesus replied, "And you experts to the law." So he turns on him. I like this. "Woe to you, because you load people down with burdens they can hardly carry." This is what scribes do, right? This is the burden. You load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will not lift one finger to help them. "Woe to you, because you build tombs for the prophets." Apparently, at this point, they were rebuilding Zechariah's tomb, which is in the Mount of Olives, or which is in the valley next to the Mount of Olives. "You build tombs for the prophets, and it was your forefathers who killed them. So you testify that you approved of what your forefathers did. They kill the prophets, and you build their tombs. Because of this, God in his wisdom said, I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill, others they will persecute. Therefore, this generation will be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that has been shed since the beginning of the world, from the blood of Abel in Genesis 4, the first book of the Hebrew Bible, to the blood of Zechariah, that's 2 Chronicles, that's the last book of the Hebrew Bible. So Jesus is going from the very beginning of the Hebrew Bible to the end of the Hebrew Bible. That we have our Hebrew Bibles, our Old Testaments have a different order than theirs did. Okay? So Genesis 4:8 to 2 Chronicles 24:20, where Zechariah was killed, who was killed between the altar and the sanctuary. "Yes, I tell you, this generation will be held responsible for it all. Woe to you experts in the law, because you've taken away the key to knowledge. And so what is the key if we look at what Jesus just said? The key is compassion, verse 46. The key is humility, verse 43. And the key is loving God, verse 42. So you've taken those things away, and you load people down with this minutia, and you shouldn't do that. You've taken away the key of knowledge. You yourself have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering. When Jesus left there, there's your travel narrative, the Pharisees and teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and besiege him with questions, wanting to catch him with something he might say. Okay? So that's the second meal. It doesn't go so well.
How did you get the keys? The keys of knowledge.
Okay. The compassion, verse 46. And I'm just deriving this from what he's just said. Okay. Compassion, verse 46. Humility, verse 43. And love of God, which is verse 42. Okay, we did read Jesus is resolutely setting his face for Jerusalem. Did we read that? We did read that. No, we didn't. Or did we? I did read. As the time approached to be taken up to heaven. Okay, I didn't read it. I'm sorry. After Peter's confession, I'm sorry, let's skip back. This will take one second. 9:51.
Chapter 9, verse
51. Huh? Yeah, we're going back. I think I overlooked this. Verse 51. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. We didn't look at that, did we? Okay, I'm sorry. I apologize. So insert after the transfiguration, this is when he begins the journey. I'm sorry. Gee, I had a five-hour energy drink. I thought that would help me, but it just scrambled my brain even more. This is kind of the whole point, 9:51. This is when the final journey begins. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem, and he sent messengers ahead of him. This is the 70, and this is where they fit into the ministry. He sent messengers ahead of him. They went into Samaritan village to get things ready for him, but the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. That's the little key that says the travel narrative has begun. Jesus resolutely sets his face for Jerusalem. That's where it begins. And it always begins after Peter's confession and the transfiguration. Okay, so I'm so sorry I left that out. Will you forgive me? I've been working on a chicken coop all day, so... So the travel narrative between chapters 9 and 19 begins. And during this travel narrative, he has meal fellowship twice with the Pharisees. That's what we're looking at. Okay, is that clear? Crystal clear. So the first meal is 11:37 through 54. And the last meal is in chapter 14. And this is a friendly meal. Sometimes we don't read it as a friendly meal because we just assume all Pharisees are bad. But I suggest to you, Jesus is giving them friendly advice on how not to be embarrassed by sitting at the wrong place at a meal. There's no woes. I mean, that meal too did not go well, right? Are we all agreed? I mean, he's pronouncing woes against them and calling on their hypocrisy. But meal one at Simon the Pharisee's house, Master, I have something to say to you. Tell me, teacher. You know, that kind of thing. Very congenial. And meal three, I suggest to you, let's look at it and see what you think. Meal three begins in chapter 14. And I just think it's important that we understand that the relationship between Jesus and the Pharisees is more complicated than we have been led to believe. They're not all bad guys. They're not all bad guys. And I suggest to you, this may be Nicodemus. What's my academic reasoning? I really want it to be true because I think it's a cool idea. Chapter 14. Again, we're on the travel narrative. We're going to Jerusalem. One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, that sounds like Nicodemus, he was prominent, he was being carefully watched. There, there in front of him was a man suffering from dropsy. Now, I looked this up in my dad's medical. My dad was a doctor, and when he was still alive, I looked this up in his medical books. This is a collection of fluid collect in your tissues, and the pictures were pretty gross. This guy's is pretty hard to look at. The medical detail, the word that Luke uses is hudropikos, that's the word for dropsy. Hudor is the Greek word for water. So it's basically you've got water retention, but it's extreme. But Jesus is going to talk about your animal falling in a well in a minute. They're all kind of water images I've never seen. I just saw those today. So let's see if you get that. So there's a man there at the meal. He's got dropsy. Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? And this is a huge thing that they argue about all the time. And what is the law? What's the Mishnah say? What do the rabbis say? You must choose the way that preserves life. That's what they came up with. So the rule is, if your donkey falls in a hole and there's no water in the hole, you can pull him out on the Sabbath because he might die down there. But if he falls in a hole and there's water in the hole, you leave him down there for the Sabbath because he can drink water and he won't die down there. We good with that? That's Jesus' world. Okay, welcome to Jesus' confusing world. Okay, so interesting, here's a man with a water disease. And Jesus says, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? They're not going to answer that question, see? But they remain silent. So, taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him away. So what do you think Jesus thinks is lawful on the Sabbath? It's lawful to heal people on the Sabbath, right? Because Sabbath was made for man. Man wasn't made for the Sabbath. So, of course, healing, you know, he heals people on the Sabbath. I told you this before. This is Mishnah, too. You can't blow a candle out on the Sabbath. Why? Because the wick becomes charcoal, and making charcoal is work. Right? You can't blow a candle out. You can't... I can't remember the other ones, but... Can't spit. Thank you. Oh, see, what a good student she is. You can't. The Pharisee says you can't spit on the Sabbath, because the spit might run downhill, and that would make mud, and making mud is work. So you can't spit on the Sabbath. Can't blow out a candle. Can't spit. You can't really do anything. You can write one letter, but not two letters on the Sabbath. There are all kinds of rules. So how does Jesus heal the blind man on the Sabbath? He spits and makes mud. And everybody loses their minds, right? Okay, that's a whole chapter in the Gospel of John. This is his world. This is his world. These kind of ridiculous, and I won't say ridiculous because that's fairly disrespectful. If your salvation depends on getting everything right, you better get it right. Right? And I'm a Pharisee. I'm going to help you with that. So if you're worried about blowing a candle out, I'm going to say, you best not do that because that's work. Best not spit. Best not write two letters. That's work. So that's the word. That's Jesus' world. Okay, sorry. Let's get back. So Jesus is at the Pharisee's house. He's being carefully watched. He heals the man with dropsy. And so taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him away. Then he asked them, if one of you has a son or an ox that falls into a well, you see the connection between dropsy and a well? I never saw that until today. He's describing the man's condition, sort of. This guy looks like he just got pulled out of a well. falls into a well on the Sabbath day. Will you not immediately pull him out? And they had nothing to say because maybe they wouldn't immediately pull him out. They're going to argue about that. But notice there's not a fight yet. When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this man your seat, then you'll be humiliated. See, this is friendly advice on how not to sit at the wrong place in a meal. He's not yelling at him. He's not calling him names. But when you're invited, take the lowest place so that when your host comes, he'll say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all your fellow guests. That's friendly advice. Now, here's the other thing that he does, and I've got a list of these if you're interested. In chapter 9 to 19, on this long journey to Jerusalem, Jesus starts speaking in maxims. He starts summing up his teaching with one-liners that are really easy to remember. And this is one of the first one, verse 11. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So he just summed up that teaching with a maxim. And that's new. He hadn't done that. He hadn't been doing that until 9 to 19. Then Jesus said to his host, when you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers, or relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they might invite you back, and so you will be repaid. Now, this is a huge category in Judaism, and it has to do with the Hebrew word hesed. Hesed is something that you do to not be repaid. If I do it for you to thank me, it's not hesed. It's not loving kindness. It's not, you know, the way God wants you to live your life. You do things that no one can thank you for. Okay? So this is, he's being very, very Jewish and very rabbinic by saying this. Hesed is when the person from whom I have a right to expect nothing gives me everything. And acts of hesed are always done not to be thanked. What are the two greatest acts of hesed? First, ladies, the first great act of hesed is to have a baby. Why? Because they don't thank you. Right? Second greatest act of hesed is to bury someone. Why? Because they can't thank you. That's Judaism. Welcome to Jesus' world. Okay? Very interesting. And do you see how he's plugging into this whole value system? They might invite you back, and so you'll be repaid. You don't want to do something they're going to repay you for. That's not hesed. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and then you'll be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous, which is a Pharisaic term. He's speaking to them in their language. They're the righteous. The resurrection of the righteous is a Pharisaic term. So very interesting. Okay? Any questions? I know this seems disjointed. It feels disjointed to me. But I just wanted to give you these two pictures of these two meals. And in one meal, it doesn't go so well. And he calls them on their hypocrisy. And the other meal, it's just friendly advice. He's giving them friendly advice. And so what I want to do now is go on and go to the final entry. And next week we'll do the crucifixion and the resurrection. Okay? So we will have overviewed. Oh gosh, we're almost out of time. I wanted to look at Zacchaeus. But we don't have time. Let's look at the triumphal entry, 1928. Yeah, my note says, Zacchaeus, if you have time. We don't have time. The triumphal entry. And I always, the so-called triumphal entry, it's not the triumph that everyone pictures it as being. Is there a momentary group of excited people around Jesus? Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's not the way it's pictured. This huge crowd, they're coming for Passover. They're not all there with Jesus, okay? Are you interested in comparing the other Gospels? Let me give this to you really quick. You don't write this down, just listen. These are the details. In Matthew, the arrangements for donkey are made. They go in early, they get the donkey, but only Matthew mentions the colt. Zechariah 9:9 is quoted, Matthew uses it as a fulfillment formula because that's what Matthew does. Everything Jesus does in Matthew fulfills. I mean, Jesus moves to Nazareth And he says, this is to fulfill what, you know, that he would be a Nazarene. And I defy you to find that verse. The robes and branches are put on the ground in Matthew. One of the uniquenesses of Matthew says the whole city was shaken. So people are upset that he's come. They say, this is the prophet from Nazareth in Galilee, the son of David. And the second temple cleansing happens. And the unique thing about Matthew's rendition is the blind and the lame come to Jesus. Matthew says that. And guess what? Blind people and lame people aren't allowed in the temple. But when Jesus goes in and cleans it out, the blind and the lame come to him in the temple. So that's pretty cool. Okay, so that's what's unique about Matthew. Here's what's unique about Mark. The arrangement for the donkey happens, but Mark says no one's ever ridden on this donkey. And that's an important detail because that means a king can use it. Kings use things that no one else have used. It's very important that Jesus is buried in a tomb that no one's ever been laid in. That means it's fit for a king to use. Okay, so he rides a donkey that no one's ever ridden because that's what kings do. His entrance into Jerusalem is very clearly speaking of his kingship. Okay, so no one's ever ridden. The robes and the branches are put on the floor. They sing, they call out, Hosanna, which means, oh, save, exclamation point. What's unique about Mark's account is Jesus goes into the temple and looks around and then goes back to Bethany. So there's no confrontation. Mark doesn't talk about that. When Mark talks about the cleansing, we have the cursing of the fig tree. That's unique. And Jesus won't permit people to carry things through the temple. That's unique in Mark. So Matthew tells us that the blind and the lame come to him, but very strict Judaism. He won't let people carry things in the temple. That's like right out of Judaism 101. So John, what's unique about John? The crowd hears that Jesus is coming and they go out to meet him. Only John tells us that. Jesus finds the colt. There's no details of the prearrangement. John whispers that Jesus' disciples didn't understand what was happening. Only later did they understand. Remember, John's the gospel that whispers. John's explaining things. So they really didn't understand what they were doing. They only understood that later. Only John tells us that. Only John tells us that those who had been at Lazarus' tomb were there. So that's one reason why I think people are so excited. He's just raised Lazarus from the dead. When Jesus enters Jerusalem, there's a dead guy and a blind guy on either side of him. He's just healed both of them, raised both of them. And those are messianic miracles. Only the Messiah can heal someone who's born blind. Only the Messiah can raise someone who's been dead for 3 days. Only the Messiah does that. Okay, so he did two messianic miracles. And that's according to this book, to their book. John leaves out the second temple cleansing because he's told us about the first temple cleansing. Jesus tears up the temple twice. It's the first public thing he does in John, and in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's the last public thing he does. Okay? So there we are. So let's look at Luke's version of the triumphal entry. Everybody good? I feel like I'm disjointed and too confused tonight. I'm sorry. Okay? Sorry. This is 1928. After Jesus has said this, he went on ahead going up, and you always go up to Jerusalem. You'll hear Jewish people say, I'm going to make Aliyah. That means to go up. But when a Jew says that, it means they're going up to Jerusalem. That's pilgrimage, okay? I'm going to make Aliyah, okay? So he's making Aliyah to Jerusalem. He's walking up the same road that the parable of the Good Samaritan was told on. He's going up that road. As he approached Bethphage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you'll find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. There's that detail. And I suggest to you that this is Mark's house. The Last Supper is in Mark's house. And I suggest to you his connection. I won't be dogmatic about it. I just think it's a really cool idea. I think... they go into the town and they get this this donkey. And Matthew will tell us a donkey with its colt. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it? Tell him, the Lord needs it. Those who were sent went and found it just as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, why are you untying the colt? They replied, the Lord needs it. So is this prophetic or some kind of miraculous thing? Or is this just a prearranged thing that Jesus did with, you know, Mark? Who knows? And apparently Luke thinks we don't need to know. I would have liked to know that detail, but he didn't tell us. They brought it to Jesus. They threw their cloaks on the colt and put Jesus on it. As he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. And this is where Matthew quotes Zechariah 9:9. Behold, your king comes riding on the foal of a donkey. When he came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives. Why is that? Do you hear that? That's a detail. They came near to the place. So what just happened? He just went over the Mount of Olives. There's a big valley, and then here's the temple. This is, when you start going down, this is the first time that you could see the whole temple complex. Okay? And this is in the this is the place where everybody starts singing. You've come a long way. You come over the top of the hill, and there's the temple. Okay? 35 acres, this incredible temple. It would have been one of the seven wonders of the world if it had been around when that list was made by Herodotus. It's covered with gold and white marble. There were Romans who became tourists and came to Jerusalem just to see the temple. They didn't care about Judaism or God or sacrifices. It was a tourist attraction. So, I mean, how cool is that? It was this incredibly beautiful thing all covered with gold, colonnade all around it, 35 acres. The tops of each one of those columns was covered with gold. I mean, it was a glorious, glorious thing to see. So what happens? They come over the hill and they see this place. The whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they'd seen. They see the kind of the goal. This is where we're going. We're going to the temple. And they start singing. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. There's the kingship piece. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. That's what the angels sang in chapter 2. Now his disciples are singing it as he enters Jerusalem. How cool is that? That's 2:14. Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, Teacher, rebuke your disciples. See, this is not appropriate. I tell you, he replied, if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out. And that's a reference to Habakkuk 2:11. At this point, everything that comes out of his mouth is going to be an allusion to the Old Testament. Everything he does is going to fulfill some prophecy. It's amazing. So that's an allusion to Habakkuk. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it. Two words in Greek for weeping. Edakrasen. And when he comes to see Lazarus, it's edakrasen. The Greek word for tear is dakru. So edakrasen is just a tear falling down your cheek. The other Greek word for crying is klio. So I think it's where we get our word cry from. And that's to weep. That's to boohoo. And that's the word that's used here. He sees Jerusalem and he just loses it. He starts weeping audibly. He saw the city, he wept over it and said, if you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it's hidden from you. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you. And that happens at 70 AD. Titus surrounds the city. There is cannibalism inside the city. I mean, the siege of Jerusalem was horrific. There's a story in Josephus about a woman cooking her own child and eating it. And some soldiers come and she offers some of the child to the soldiers to eat. And they walk away shuddering. I mean, the siege of Jerusalem was horrific. And Jesus will say, nothing this bad has ever happened or will ever happen again. And people will say, well, no, that's got to be the end of the world. I think he's referring to 70 AD. I mean, it was horrific what happened. People were crucified all along. They ran out of wood to crucify people with. So outside the walls of the city, the Romans were crucifying people just to let them see, you know, this is what's going to happen to you when we get in there. Look up Josephus's, because Josephus was there. Look up Josephus' account of the siege of Jerusalem. It was horrific. And Jesus sees that and weeps. He starts weeping. He knows what's going to happen. The days will come upon you when enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They built a wall of circumvallation all the way around the city. And it's a wall that's not that big, but it's the Romans' way of saying, you're not getting out. See this wall? You're not getting out. They did it around Masada, too. You can still see the one in Masada. Remember? There's this little wall, this wall of circumvallation. It's just terror tactic. You're not getting out. It's pretty terrifying. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another. And that is literally fulfilled. And that's why today we're not even sure where the temple was, because they completely demolished the city. Because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. We should stop right there. We're over time. Yeah. Any questions? I just feel so disjointed. I'm sorry. So anyway, 9 to 19 is that final journey to Jerusalem. He starts speaking in maxims. He starts concentrating his teaching. He talks about his suffering. And in ever-increasing detail, he tells exactly what's going to happen to him, and they just don't hear it. They argue amongst themselves about what rising from the dead might mean. And they're afraid. He talks about being crucified, and they're afraid to ask him about it. Really interesting. So, and don't roll your eyes, because you would have done the same thing, and so would I. Yeah. Okay? Boy, there's just no energy in this room. If you feel tired to me. What? Yeah, we're done.